Internet Talk Radio, Flame of the Internet.
This is Geek of the Week. We're talking to Major Michael St. Johns, who's a program manager at the Advanced Research Projects Agency. Welcome to Geek of the Week, Mike.
Thanks, Carl.
Program manager at ARPA is a position with a long, proud tradition. Vince Cerf was a program manager, and Dick Desjardins was before he went off to NASA and formed the Gossip Institute. What made you want to leave your technical work and become a government bureaucrat?
Leave my technical work and become a government bureaucrat. You show up in the Air Force and that's sort of what you become.
What do you do as a program manager?
Well, finish the first question. I mean, Paul Makapetris came and just sort of blew his little, his little flute, and it's like the Pied Piper of Hamelin, and he drags people off and into ARPA and never to be seen again. ARPA funds basic research and networking. Basic research in a lot of topics, and my area is networking. We basically try and recruit the best and brightest researchers in the country at the leading edge, as far in advance of the leading edge of technology as makes sense, and get them to do the right thing.
Do you set the research priorities, or do you just respond to proposals from the researchers?
We set the research priorities. Before people give us proposals, we basically issue this thing called a broad agency announcement, a BAA, and that'll list the broad area of interest for maybe a year or maybe 6 months, depending on how fast the technology is turning over and how fast the needs are coming with respect to the rest of the programs. Once that closes, we will get a host of proposals, anywhere from as few as 10, depending on how focused the BAA up to as many as I've seen 150 in one BAA. Fortunately, not mine. They're evaluated, and then we skim off the cream and select those proposals and fund them.
What kind of money are we talking here? How much does ARPA spend on networking research?
On networking research, it's a little bit difficult to say, but it's somewhere in the $30 to $50 million range, everything thrown into the pot. There's a lot of I have such a large range there because there are things that are networking like that are not necessarily in my program. They may be in distributed computing, they may be in another program. Related more to the operational military than my program is.
Yeah, $30 to $50 million is a significant fraction of the research money going in that area in the United States, I would think.
Yeah.
What are some of the areas that you want to see networking evolve into? What are the areas that you're funding or pushing research in?
Well, the major area that I've started working in is the security area and networking. I was at the Defense Data Network Program during the era of the worm, and I really resent being wakened up at 2 o'clock in the morning to be told yet another machine has gone and bitten the dust. We've got this very large internet that has continued to grow and grow, and we really haven't made the investment in protecting the infrastructure that we really need for something this large. The emphasis that I've got is basically providing enough tools in a ubiquitous manner to basically build 6-foot fences. It's sort of you can spend a lot of dollars and build Fort Knox, but you can't build very many of them. Whereas you can spend a little bit of money and give everybody the technology to build the 6-foot fences, and you get a pretty good benefit on a worldwide basis because it spreads out very well.
So, for example, I believe ARPA funds the CERT, the Computer Emergency Response Team at Carnegie Mellon.
That's correct.
Is that an example of a 6-foot fence?
That's sort of an example of the exterminator more than the 6-foot fence. That's been in existence since roughly 4 hours after we closed down the emergency with the worm. And that's actually funded out of a different area. That's funded by another program manager. But that's a good model for at least one piece of the puzzle. You can't do it all in the computer or in the network. You have to have good people available to provide for the security of the system or the continued operation of the system.
Are there technologies that we should be looking at, such as public key cryptography, that your group can help develop further? Are you looking at public key, for example?
Yeah. The areas of research I'm concentrating in are not the crypto mathematics, but using the existing technology, such as the various public key methods, Diffie-Hellman, RSA, the digital signature standard from NIST, DES, which isn't a public key method, and using and incorporating those into the existing technology base and providing the links in. We've got a couple of programs that have started, for example, to protect the domain name system, basically signed information that's in there. I've got another program working on intrusion detection. I've got another one on mobile computing and dealing with the security issues around that.
Well, for the domain name system, for example, are you looking at storing public keys in DNS, or what are you looking at?
It's the other end around it. It's the other end of it. It's signing the information into the DNS so you can trust it more. There's a lot of attacks that people have published or talked about where a lot of the behavior of the network depends on where you come from. A good example being Unix R commands, which all are based on what IP address you come from or what name you come from. If you can spoof the DNS to return bad answers to those questions, you can actually do some pretty annoying damage within a particular within a community that uses these things. If you have assigned DNS, at least that takes away one route of attack.
So do you hope the result of that research will be an RFC and deployment, or is this going to be just a paper? Are you doing infrastructure development here?
RFC and an RFC on the changes, changes with respect to DNS to bind as the reference release. So that'll be basically generally available to anybody who wants it. And infrastructure deployment, at least on some of the networks that we run and control. The idea being it's an incremental deployment, so you don't have to do it if you don't want to, you don't think it makes sense, but the second time you get bit, you have the tool available to come and solve the problem.
Mike St. John's, we've been talking about security problems on the Internet and some of the research that you've been funding. You discussed mobile IP and some of the security implications there. Maybe you can elaborate on what's going to happen to the Internet, particularly with regard to security, as we begin to be mobile and wireless and use some of these other new technologies that are emerging.
Well, the most interesting problem isn't actually, believe it or not, the mobile problem. Mobile problem is a hard one, but probably the most interesting one is the one I call proxy computing, where you basically let the network operate on your behalf, or components of the network operate on your behalf, either while you're attached to them and they're going off and doing things, or while you're away and it's operating to go off and find particular references to information that you're looking for, to maybe balance your checkbook. The semi-autonomous type of stuff that we read about in science fiction and we hope for tomorrow. It's very critical that we provide a path so that you can let the network act as if it were you without being able to corrupt that thing that's acting as if it were you into doing things it shouldn't do or things that you haven't told it it can do. So that's one part of the problem. With a mobile computing problem, a lot of it can be handled by standard cryptography, just either encrypting the relationship between the mobile component and the base component and providing some signature data there or by other relatively common techniques that we're using today. It's it's going to be harder as we keep continuing to get larger to do the right thing, and we're just trying to do it earlier.
Do we know what we need to know in order to secure the Internet? Is it just a matter of deploying the current knowledge, or do we need to learn something new?
We need to learn something new on the basis that most of the systems we've got today don't scale well. They work reasonably well if you control the whole domain you're involved in. A whole campus, a whole company, a whole organization, a whole network. The moment you start splitting your domains, for example, if you came to visit us, you wouldn't, as of right now, you're not allowed to sit down in one of our terminals and go through our system to your system. It's a penetration of our security barrier on the way out, and maybe a penetration of your security barrier on the way in. We'd like to solve that problem. We don't really know how to do that on a reasonable basis, on a worldwide basis. So the major problem there is scaling. There's probably some research that needs to be done on the cryptography. Every signature algorithm we've got where you go off and you verify and validate the data requires a longer and longer string of digits to say that somebody has signed it. Every time you change or every time you want somebody else to validate it, we need that. That's another thing that we probably need to work on.
There's been a lot of activity for a long time in the Internet on security. And the Internet Architecture Board has looked at a variety of proposals, and some people have criticized the IAB. You're a recent member, so you can't speak for the past. Some people have criticized the IAB and said that by trying to do security right, we've ended up with no security at all. Is there a middle ground someplace there that needs to be attacked?
Yeah, I think there is. There are various existing protocols today, existing implementations that would benefit a lot from relatively cheap and inexpensive fixes to them.
What are some examples?
Well, I mean, for example, Telnet. We're talking about providing an encryption path for Telnet, providing additional stuff to basically meld in Kerberos, the authentication protocol that MIT developed. There's probably things we could do with respect to FTP. We could probably provide some encryption path for privacy for the base TCP stuff. Part of the problem really has not been one of a technical nature, but in many cases of a policy nature. We have a very big problem in this country and in most of the countries that subscribe to the COCOM, and don't ask me what COCOM stands for, I keep forgetting, about exporting cryptography in any form, and that includes even DES, data encryption standard stuff. So we need to work past all of this stuff, and we're finally coming to critical mass on a lot of these issues. At the last IETF, I saw progress in about a half a dozen groups with respect to real security coming out of them in one flavor or another. Unfortunately, it's not the grand unified security theory that we were hoping for, but at least it provides benefits. 3.5-foot fences.
Well, 3.5 is better than none, isn't it?
That's right.
St. John's, you were one of the original people to attend the very first IETF meeting. In fact, I understand you were at the meeting before the IETF meeting. How long ago was that?
86, I think it was. It was, we were meeting with a group called the Gateway Gateway Algorithms and Data Structures, chaired by a guy named Dave Mills. And my boss at the time, Mike Corrigan, who's now with GSA, came in like an avenging angel and said, "I've just come from the IAB and we're going to do nastiness to you." The next thing we knew, the GADS group had been dissolved, and in its place stood the Internet Engineering Task Force and the Internet Architecture Task Force. Mike Corrigan took over the Internet Engineering Task Force. Dave Mills kept up with the Internet Architecture Task Force. For about the first 2 or 3 months, they kept trying to call us INANG and INARC. The IETF, obviously, the simpler IETF won out. And since that time, we've grown from an organization that could comfortably meet in a conference room with 30 chairs to an organization where the working groups have problems meeting in a room with 30 chairs. The growth has been phenomenal, and it would be interesting plotting the growth of the IETF against the growth of the Internet, seeing what we get.
Why has it grown so quickly? Why haven't people gone to the IETF and then said, "Well, gee, this is interesting, now let's go do it right and go to the ISO committees," for example? Why has the IETF been such a focus for development?
Well, the first half dozen or dozen meetings, somewhere in that, were basically just straight meetings. You'd come in, you'd talk about the operational problems of the network, you'd identify what needed to be changed in the research agenda, but there was no real work done with respect to protocols and stuff. That was still being funded either by ARPA, by the National Science Foundation. This was the era where the original NSFNet backbone with the fuzzballs, yeah, I can't remember, were being phased out, and the new NSFNet was being phased in. The new being relative terms, because it's now being phased out. The IETF has been successful because the people who have had, among other things, operational responsibility for the networks have been involved in setting the agenda for the IETF and actually creating the products which they then turn around and run on their own networks. We didn't grow very much in the early years until we started the working groups concept, and since then we've really grown. It was sort of like we were waiting for catalyst. We had 3 or 4 working groups at the first meeting that we had the thing at, and we've got 80 now. We've got more working groups than original members.
You mentioned the significant operational experience of the members. As the IETF grows and scales, obviously there's a more diffuse membership that begins to attend. Is there a way we can keep that operational focus in the IETF and yet still keep it open to all members and keep it growing?
Well, we've made some good steps towards that. I think probably the best thing we've done in recent years is the multicast. If you take a look at who's listening in and you start looking at these guys and say, okay, he has software responsibility for networking. He's learning about networking at the school. Oh, an operator. You start seeing the people on the M-bone who aren't showing up to the IETS, but they're still listening in on what's happening. And you still get a lot of the participation out of the IETF meetings, per se, on the mailing list. So there's still this cross-fertilization. I don't think we'll lose that.
So the working groups that used to work are the ones that used electronic mail, so they kept on working. And it sounds like the working groups in the future that are going to work are going to be the ones that also use the network. And so it's not just a place to have fine dinners. It's a place to culminate the work that's been going on.
The major benefit to going to an IETF meeting over dealing with the mailing list is basically getting a baseline personality for the people that you're going to be dealing with over the mailing list. If any of you have met Steve Knowles, for example, Steve in person is a lot like his mailing list persona, but you start understanding where he's coming from a little bit faster and a little bit better. And it's very useful in dealing with him, and that applies with, I'm sure, dealing with me or even dealing with you, Carl. There are people who have been around long enough, it's sort of like everybody knows them.
But it's always nice to meet people.
It's always nice to meet people, and you start thinking about it, even after you've been talking with them just a short period of time, you start thinking about the last email you got from them, and you relate it against their personality and say, oh, that's what he meant, and that's why he put it that way. And it's a lot, and you get a lot more emotional content, and you get the clues that you won't normally get over electronic mail.
Now, this is a global network, and the IETF is beginning to do one meeting per year outside of the U.S., and in fact, with Asia going great guns with the Internet, and Europe as always continuing to help lead in some of the development efforts. Is it going to be harder to have IETF meetings? Are we going to have to spend our lives on airplanes traveling to faraway places?
Well, I mean, when we started this thing out, there were IETF meetings every quarter. We're down to three a year. The original deal was that there would be an IETF meeting sort of in conjunction with Interop when that basically got spun up, and that just sort of died on us. I think the three meetings a year will probably continue. It's the 4 month period is almost too long between talking with people in some cases because the technology is changing so much. But we're learning to substitute through teleconferencing, through the M-Bone stuff. I've recently found myself going downstairs and using the tool from ISI, the multimedia multicast conference controller stuff, which basically allows me to dial up on a multimedia type of interface a list of people who have the same stuff and use the M-Bone to do some of the work. Keeps me from traveling. I think the more we get, the more what distinguishes the IETF and its group more than anything else from the ISO is that we use the tools that we develop to develop the tools that we develop the tools. There's always a cycle going on. There used to be back in Rome, ancient Rome, I'm getting off the track a little bit, but when the Romans built the bridge, they made the designer, the architect, live under the bridge for 20 years. It's a very strong guarantee that the bridge would continue to operate for 20 years. We tend to live on the Internet in the IETF, and that's a very strong guarantee that the Internet will continue to operate.
So a requirement, if you issue an RFC, is that you must use the software for the next 5 years.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I unfortunately have issued a couple of RFCs of myself that have come back to haunt me that I wish we weren't using. But we will from time to time get the bad stuff in there. But it turns out that there's sort of an evolution going on or a Darwin type effect where, you know, only the strongest survive. Before my time on the IAB, the IAB declared CMIP and SNMP code standards with respect to the Internet. Frankly, I don't think I've even seen an advertisement for CMIP products in the communications rags in the last 6 to 12 months. SNMP's all over the place. So.
Yeah, no, that clearly has won. There is a major vendor which still uses CMIP in its architecture, but as you said, the advertisements tend to be for SNMP these days. As a recent member of the IAB, the IAB has changed its character over the last year or so. A lot of the original members have resigned. There's a new generation that's there. What do you see the role for the IAB being?
Well, we've been discussing it almost incessantly since the thing changed. It was kind of I got roped into it. It was like I got asked, will you serve? And I was sick that day.
That's what you said, yes,
and
right?
So I said yes. Right now, the role I think the IAB sees for itself is sort of the architectural purity of the system, and I use purity in a very loose sense, considering what we're talking about with respect to the IETF. We're basically just trying to do the right thing. At the last IETF, Christian and Barry, Christian Heitma, who's the chair, and Barry Liner, who's another IAB member, got up and talked about the multi-protocol internet and basically said, well, okay, that's fine, but we believe that we ought to have just one common internet layer protocol. And that was taken very well, especially considering some of the things the IAB has said before and people have reacted to. I think that's where we're going with this.
But is that enough to say we need a single protocol? Shouldn't you be saying which one it is? I mean, it's enough to say, gee, we need open systems, but, I mean, how? How do we do it?
Well, as I recall, again, before my time, the IAB said at a certain meeting in Japan, you know, we know what IP the next generation is going to be, or IPv7, and I think at that time it was TUBA, and basically, I'm surprised most of them came back to the United States. You know, there were lynching parties waiting for them.
So this is the IB basically got up and said, we think the direction we ought to move is the connectionless network protocol as modified as necessary, but the reaction from the community was, you know, how dare you tell us what the answer is when we don't know the questions yet.
Right, and in fact that resulted in a lot of the changes that we saw with respect to the relationship between the IAB and the IETF IESG stuff. Right now, you know, the IAB is sort of looking at us as the 12 wise men, or I think it sort of looks at itself as sort of the 12 wise men.
Wise people, actually, for the first time.
Yes, we have Elise there. I'm sorry, Elise. who reign but do not rule. It's sort of, we've sort of turned into the, you know, constitutional monarchy type of situation.
So the 12 of you together form a kind of virtual Queen Elizabeth, if you will. Well, thank you very much. We've been talking to Mike St. John's from ARPA, and this has been Geek of the Week.
Internet Talk Radio, Flame of the Internet. You've been listening to Geek of the Week. You may copy this program to any medium and change the encoding, but may not alter the data or sell the contents. To purchase an audio cassette of this program, send mail to radio@ora.com. Support for Geek of the Week comes from Sun Microsystems. Sun, the network is the computer. Support for Geek of the Week also comes from O'Reilly & Associates, publishers of The Global Network Navigator, your online hypertext magazine. For more information, send mail to info@gnn.com. Network connectivity for the Internet Multicasting Service is provided by MFS DataNet and by UUNet Technologies. Executive producer for Geek of the Week is Martin Lucas. Production manager is James Rowland. Rick Dunbar and Curtis Jenris are the sysadmins. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.